Hello, my name is Roseanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Roseanne.
Hi. I'm also a wife, a sister, a daughter, a stepmom, and a worker among workers. But most of all, I'm a child of God. I would like to thank Eva from the General Service Office for allowing me the honor and blessing to speak to you on prayer under pressure. No pressure there. I would also like to thank my husband for always supporting me, loving me through the under pressure times, and always being there when I needed the face of God to look me in the eyes and tell me it's going to be okay. I would also like to thank my sponsor in my home group, Morning Meditation Group in Costa Mesa, California, 6:45, Monday through Friday. Yeah. Be there. Be there. We will welcome you with open arms and sharing and hugging and all that kind of stuff. And I also want to thank my AA family in California. They know me and they call me on my crazy stuff and, of course, are keeping me honest today, as I know several of them are in the rooms. All right. Don't say anything while I'm talking, okay? Okay. I was recently asked, after a very intense day of stuff going on, so how do you deal with pressure? What's going on with you? How are you dealing with pressure right now? I had no answer except I'm exhausted. I just don't have anything left. I'm so tired. I felt beat up and had no prayers, nothing. My friend who asked me that question said, now that's where you begin your talk. You've been beaten up all day, so what do you do under pressure? I have to admit, I was surprised that I had no answer for her. But what she gave me that day was a new perspective. It seems I like to think that when the stuff hits the fan, I run to God. But that day I hadn't. I forgot to pray and went to pick up my friend to go to a meeting. I didn't think about prayer until she suggested we pray in the car before we got out, you know, which we did. But did I remember that? No. Not until she said it at 3:00 in the afternoon when we were leaving. So I can tell you I pray under pressure, but that's not the truth. Not all the time. Now, there have been times when I knew I'd have a really tough and challenging day, and I'd pray before a meeting, pray before, you know, I took a cup of coffee, pray before every phone call, before every email. And this particular day was an opportunity for me to really look at Roseanne, who was not only under pressure, but was beat down and tired and feeling like I had been the target of every smart aleck, not nice comment. I felt like I just didn't do anything right. But what I've learned in AA is that you can start your day over anytime you want. And that is what I had to do. I started again by thanking God for the crazy day and all the crazy people that were there, and especially for my friend giving me a place to start. So let's start with definitions. I like to define words so that I'm clear on what I'm doing and what I'm talking about. So I went to my handy-dandy online dictionary, and I looked up prayer, under, and pressure. Prayer, a devout petition to God or an object of worship. A spiritual communion with God or an object of worship, as in supplication, thanksgiving, adoration, or confession. Under, in the position or state of bearing, supporting, sustaining, enduring, to give in, succumb, or yield. Pressure, the state of being pressed or compressed, the exertion of force upon a surface by an object, fluid, etc., harassment, oppression, a constraining or compelling force or influence. Lots of words, right? So what this topic really means, in simple terms, is my petition to God, while I'm in a state of enduring, succumbing, or yielding to this state of being compressed, oppressed, or harassed. Yep, that's it. I get it. I totally understand. Now that I know that, what do I do about all this petitioning, yielding, and compressing? Well, I know I should go straight to God, the big book, or someone I know that can help me decompress so I can go to God or the big book. Again, AA has taught me that on those occasions when I'm confused, lost, or just plain defiant, I can call someone and ask for help. I'm glad I knew to do that when I was working in a job in sobriety that allowed me to resign quickly and quietly instead of them bringing me up on federal charges. Nice of them. I'm glad I knew what to do when my brother-in-law had eye cancer, when my sister had breast cancer and heart surgery, and when my mother passed away, and when we had to put my dog to sleep. I knew to do that when people died, when jobs were lost, and when friends were in trouble. But on this particular day I mentioned, just a few months ago, when the day wasn't going my way and people were being mean to me, I wasn't too spiritually fit, and I forgot my basics. The Big Book tells me that I must be spiritually fit on a daily basis in order to transmit the message of hope and recovery. For me, that's why it has so many prayers, especially in the steps. For me, prayer is how I get and maintain my spiritual fitness. There are prayers for our spouses and families, for fear, for people who are sick like us. There's a prayer for sex, for resentments, and making amends. We have prayers for each step, and there's the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, prayer for anger, prayer to love more and hurt people less, and prayer for God's will in our lives. I found out that any time it says, we ask in the Big Book, there's usually a prayer right after those two words. You get where I'm going with this, right? It's all there. But when it comes down to it, why don't I go to God right away and petition Him for help for whatever I need? Why is it that sometimes I do and sometimes I don't? Why is that the hardest thing for me to remember? After some thinking, but not too much, I came up with the reason. It's because I'm still human and I still think I'm general manager of the universe. I thought I gave that title up a long time ago, but apparently I haven't. That alcoholic thinking can still be a problem, and when I'm on a roll, I'm on a roll. Just ask the people who know me. I'm telling you, and those brilliant ideas come back faster than I can beat them down. And every once in a while, I get a good one, and the next thing you know, I'm scheming a plan to fix this, change that, do this, direct that, direct you. Yeah, you know, it just happens. While I was preparing for this panel, I did some research on what Bill had to say on prayer and this thing I just mentioned, this me syndrome. And I got this information from an article on emotional sobriety called The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety by Bill Wilson, copyright A.A. Grapevine, January 1958. That was a good year. It's the year I was born. Don't tell anybody. I'm 50-something. Yeah. Okay. Since A began, I've taken immense wallops in these areas. And he was talking about security, approval, and romance. Because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover finally that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living, well, that's not always the neurotic's problem. It's a problem of life itself for all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to hew the right principles in all our affairs. Even then, as we hew away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA oldsters have come to. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I began to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn, depression, having no real rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't this 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence, on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams and specifications, I had fought for them, and when defeat came, so did my depression. It's really hard being general manager of the universe. Has anybody ever tried that? Yeah. Okay, just checking. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, and upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis had. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing a love appropriate to each relation of life. Plainly, I could not avail myself of God's love until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as He would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. You know what I mean? So there it was. All this dependency on others, my circumstances, and Lord forbid, even myself, to give me what I needed. This realization was frightening for me, because any time I had depended on Roseanne in the past, the results were not good. I wound up with a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was what happened on that fateful day months ago. I had taken the reins back from God. Like I could really do that. Can you imagine me in a tug of war with God? You know, I kind of laugh when I think about that. Although I've tried. I really have. But that was what I did. And my friend's simple question, how are you dealing with pressure right now, came crashing down on top of me, and I had to surrender to my crazy thinking, my brilliant ideas, and finally, yes, finally, to God. What a concept. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Could it be that simple, going back to basics, the steps, and God transforming me? Aha! I was beaten by a beverage while I was drinking, and now I'm beaten by a Roseanne. How absolutely alcoholic of me. On step 11, in step 11 on page 97 and 98 in the 12 and 12, it says, those of us who have come to make regular use of prayer would no more do without it than we would refuse air, light, or food. The body suffers. And when we turn away from prayer and meditation, we likewise deprive our minds, our emotions, and our intuitions of vitally needed support. As the body can fail its purpose for lack of nourishment, so can the soul. We all need the light of God's reality, the nourishment of His strength, and the atmosphere of His grace. To an amazing extent, the facts of AA life confirm this ageless truth. So they are saying that I need prayer in order for my soul to live, and without my soul, what am I? Just an empty shell, someone I do not want to return to being. That Roseanne died to self on September 8, 1994. I don't want her back. My life is worth so much more now. I no longer believe I'm worthless. I have a purpose today, which is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Pretty simple, right? I would like to say that I went home that day and began doing my prayer and meditation in earnest. Nah, took about two more days of awful, feeling awful and, you know. But I began that journey back to emotional sobriety, to spiritual fitness. And as a result, I stand before you today on the other side of the pressure. There'll be no more pressure after this. I'm a lot happier, and surprise, surprise, my heart is a lot lighter. Am I praying every day now? Yeah, I am, because that just happened, right? Am I getting the benefits of prayer? Yes, I am. Is that the end of the story? No, nope, it's not. I would like to offer some advice, though, before I go away, if you don't mind. Whatever you do, don't stop praying. When times are good, bad, or indifferent, don't stop praying. When someone dies or you lose a job or your family member gets sick, don't stop praying. Because you see, if you don't pray constantly in good or bad times, how will you get into the habit of praying instead of drinking? How do you lose your mother and not drink? How do you go to the hospital and watch a dear friend slip away and not drink? How do you manage to live sober under pressure? I want to share a quick story with you. Kind of went back and forth on this because it's kind of embarrassing, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because you're family and you're not going to tell anybody, right? Is this being taped? Oh. On September 12th, 2014, I just get so excited. 4 days after my 20th birthday, my 20th AA birthday, you really thought it was my chronological 20th birthday, didn't you? Yeah. I was told I was going to be terminated for my job of 10 years. And so began my nine-month-long journey of finding out who Roseanne was. And as I trudged this particular road, what I call unhappy destiny, I found myself, you guessed it, in prayer, under pressure, every single day for 9 months. Usually when people get fired, they're given their last paycheck and told to get out. But this particular process, for whatever reason, was prolonged for nine long, arduous, long months. I spent every day praying, asking God to direct my thinking, to give me the strength to deal with all the politics that was going on. I believed he had a greater plan for me, greater than I could imagine. I believed he was giving me an opportunity to grow more towards him and to depend on him, not myself, for the courage to continue this process and to see it to the end. I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. I knew he had a plan. It just wasn't time for me to know it yet. And as the months went on, I got a little bit more irritable and discontent. I started snapping at people, but I didn't stop praying. I started crying all the time, as any good alcoholic would. I stopped going to my home group because of a new work schedule, but I didn't stop praying. I began to think my husband didn't like me anymore and my friends were tired of me, but I didn't stop praying. And finally, one day I snapped. It was that day a few months ago that I was talking about a little bit earlier. I had stopped praying and I didn't even realize it. What I found out was faith without works is dead, and works without faith is equally dead. I hadn't stopped praying, but it became empty prayer, a cursory, "Good morning, God, please give me the strength to deal with these crazy people." Where had my faith gone? I certainly believed God had a plan, but I had no faith in him. How did that happen? Well, like Bill said in his emotional sobriety article, I began depending on people, circumstances, and me. And yes, it was that simple. I was depending on everything but God. So you ask, how does the story end, Roseanne? What happened? What's next for you? Where are you going? I have no idea. But I can tell you, I'm walking with God instead of playing tug of war with him. And the path is so much easier. We're walking hand in hand on this road of happy destiny. I want to say happy birthday to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for allowing me this honor to share with you. My name's Roseanne, and I'm an alcoholic child of God.
Thanks, Roseanne. That was fabulous. I actually did meet Roseanne just a couple of days ago here at the conference before it started. And she doesn't know this, but I actually did some anonymous job sharing with her. I also was doing the general manager of the universe job. You didn't know that. And I'll bet you there's some other anonymous people who did the same thing. All right, we'll move on now to Estelle G. from South Dakota. Help me welcome Estelle.
I love the way she said South Dakota. Hi, my name is Estelle Grote, and I'm an alcoholic. She's also a black belt in karate, and she will chop me if I go beyond 20 minutes. So, my sobriety day is March 1st, 1996. My home group is the Black Sheep Group in beautiful downtown Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I have a sponsor. She's actually here, so I have to be a little more honest than. And if any of those things are out of whack, I'm out of whack. And those are the things that have kept me grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. Quick AA story before I start here. So Bill and I are visiting before we start meeting, and him and his beautiful wife are coming to Sioux Falls next week, and we're going to have dinner. We literally just met about, a half hour ago. That is Alcoholics Anonymous to me. I have had those kinds of experiences since I first walked in the door, and I hope I always continue to have those experiences. You can't buy a better show than what happens around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our big book says in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I just want to qualify that I am an alcoholic, so I'll tell you a little bit of my story. I'm the oldest of seven children. We all have E names. My mom and dad and the rest of us, we all have these weird E names. And if you want to know, I'll tell you after the meeting. But grew up as a poor kid, you know, and I had to take care of these kids when I was growing up. And, gloom and despair and all of that. And I didn't know all of that was going on in my head, you know. Looking back on it, it's through inventories and working with a sponsor and that sort of thing. I didn't know that I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't know that my life was unmanageable and all that kind of stuff. One example is I somehow got a copy of Cosmo magazine when I was, 13 years old or so. And in it, it said that the guys like girls with big eyes. Well, I had these really thick glasses and I'd walk through the mall with my eyes just, you know, bugged out like that and trying to get attention, you know, always trying to get attention. They looked at me funny. They looked at me, but you know, so that's kind of the shortened version of what came when I had the opportunity, and I call it an opportunity, to have my first drink. It's funny because I asked my normal friends one time if they remember their first drink. They're like, drink of what? You know? Only in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous do people remember their first drink and vividly remember where they were, who they were with, who they puked on, and, you know, the whole nine yards. And when I grew up in South Dakota, and they had these little centennials with small-town street dances, and I was with my cousins, and I had peach schnapps and Pepsi. I was always a classy drinker, classy, very classy. But what happened to me, and it what probably doesn't happen to normal people, is when it went down into my gullet, it went, oh, ease and comfort that comes at once, you know. I remember it like it happened yesterday. It was like the monkeys that were going off in my head just went, oh, you know. And, of course, my whole life changed at that moment. I was no longer the geeky girl that was in gifted ed or special ed, whatever it was I was in, and, you know, and I thick glasses running around, that sort of thing. I was the queen of the party, you know, and it changed my whole perception on things. And I chased that. I don't remember out loud saying, I'm going to do that as often as I possibly can, but that was really what was going on. And, you know, I drank alcoholically from the get-go. Warm old Milwaukee beer under my bed before school. Yeah, real classy drinker, I'll tell you. They have all these wine things now with all these fancy wines where you're supposed to spit out the wine, apparently. I never got to do any of that, you know, which I'm glad. But anyway, so I continued on like that, and I had my first opportunity to come to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's another observation just from my years of hanging around here. Normal people don't get invited to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. Somebody might prove me wrong, but I was invited to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I don't remember much of what was said. Of course, everyone was old. They were in their 40s, you know. 42, by the way. You don't have to keep the math going. But I remember the feeling that I had in there. There was something there, you know, and carried that feeling on for quite a while. And although I didn't immediately stop drinking, I kept going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I'd be drinking while I was sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one time this guy came up to me, he said, you can stay here if you're quiet. And I looked at him like, how do you know? You know, because we know, you know. And I just thought I could have this two-way life where I could still drink, maybe collect a few medallions, go to Alcoholics Anonymous, people would stay off my back, you know, the whole gamut. And there was a lot of untruth, distruth, dishonesty, whatever you want to call it. And I thought I could make that whole plan come together. Now, God isn't in the picture here at this point in my life, you know. Yeah, the, hey, get me out of this one kind of thing. I grew up in a church, you know, it was kind of the C&E kind of thing, you know, Christmas and Easter. My mom would drag me every once in a while, but I didn't really have a relationship with God. And through good sponsorship, I've learned that relationships take work. You know, and my relationship with God hadn't even begun, in my mind anyway. He was watching over me. He was there. But so anyway, I continued to do that game of jumping in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And ironically, I got a job as a chemical dependency counselor during that period of time, too. And they frowned on you drinking on the job. I don't know. It's just something they had a problem with. And so I ended up going to treatment, made my own treatment arrangements, packed 7 suitcases, my softball glove, my tennis racket, you know, Club Med. And, you know, treatment was a discovery. I had an illness, but I was much more interested as I looked up from my big book and he looked up from his. Our eyes met. He had been to treatment 7 different times, so he was so smart, you know. We fell madly in love. Just another random observation. You shouldn't meet people in psych wards or treatment centers. Just, you know, passing it along out of experience. And, of course, that story ended like, well, it was on the 5 o'clock news. My family was horrified. He tried to, you know, it's just a horrible, horrible ordeal. But, you know, all of those events, being in jail, that sort of thing, just, it wasn't enough to stop that, because I was as physically sober as I am right now between every two drunks, you know. But I knew, you know, I always listened to Johnny Harris. That's he was the guy that when I started listening to speaker tapes, he sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. I just remember him explaining those things. And he used to say, I know what makes the big hurt go away. you know, and that applies to me. I knew what made the big hurt go away. I knew if I took a drink of whatever, it would just be for 8 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever it was. And if I could have just stopped there, I wouldn't be standing in front of you today, you know. But I couldn't. I lost all control and that sort of thing. And so anyway, I continued on with that. And my favorite part of anyone's story is the what happened part. That how do you go from, you know, destructive drinking and ruining people's lives to coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to be better, you know? And what happened for me, I had this two-year-old little boy that I was kind of dragging in and out of this whole scenario. And one day I was breaking into his piggy bank trying to get money for booze. And, you know, in the big book when it talks about that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, that was it right there. He looked up at me and he gave me that look. And it was, I started to see what I was, you know. And that was the beginning of maybe I really should listen to what they're saying in AA. It was just kind of a subconscious thought. And so I was hanging out with AA people, you know, collecting medallions, drinking at the same time. And they went to the spiritual retreat at this Blue Cloud Abbey. And it had this really cool group of monks that were all recovered alcoholics. Do they know that I'm speaking? Just kidding. Whew, where'd that come from? Anyway, these monks were all in recovery, and I got a hold of this guy named Father Francis, and I'll never forget him. He was my guy. He didn't have any teeth. He smoked like a chimney, and he swore, and he had a monk outfit on. I still haven't figured out what the monk outfit's called, but anyway, he sat down with me, and he talked to me. And we went into the chapel, and he said, just sit in here and pray until something happens. Okay, those places are scary, you know? And I just kind of sat there, and there was no flash of light. There was no overwhelming sensation that I should go do good for others or anything like that. It was just something. And I went back home and decided to be honest about the fact that, hey, I'm not sober, you know? I've been drinking, and I actually got a sobriety date. I always love to ask people their sobriety dates, and if they kind of hinge a little bit, I'm like, yeah, I've been there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started that journey, and at the time, I was in a smaller community. There weren't a whole lot of women that were coming to meetings, and so this gentleman came up to me, and he said, I'll be your sponsor until you find a chick sponsor. And he was an older, trusted gentleman, and we went through the big book line by line by line. And honestly, it's my favorite book because it talks about me. You know, I saw me in there all over the place. You know, when Bill talks about whirling fat checks. Yeah, I was a whirler. Yeah, I whirled fat checks, that's for sure. You know, things like that. And I got active in service very early on, about 3 months sober. I needed to have an activity in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep me here. And so I became the district secretary and just all these kinds of things. And I just got in the middle of the pack. You know, and hopefully, God's grace, I'll stay in the middle of the pack because that's where it's safe. And continued on, I've had the privilege of serving as your delegate. I was a panel 56 delegate. Had the privilege to just do all kinds of things that I just would never imagine. You know, the story I told you about Bill, I mean, it can be multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. So I went on like that for quite a while. And so when I was thinking about this topic, prayer under pressure, you know, I don't know that there was a lot of pressure when I didn't have a relationship with God because I didn't know what the alternative was, because that life that I told you about was the only normal life I'd ever known. You know, I didn't know any better. But, you know, once I got into sobriety and started working the steps and started coming to believe in a power greater than myself, there was pressure moments, you know, like, okay, well, I want to do good on this. I want to do this. But I'll tell you a story of I was about 15 years sober. This was just a few years ago. And I'm sitting in meetings at my home group looking at people going, you're going to say the same thing you said last week. You're going to do the same thing. Oh, look, she's in another relationship. Oh, look, over there. And I was really just not in a real good spot, still sponsoring gals and still doing the deal, but there was something in my heart that wasn't quite there. And I thought, you know, who would really know if I skipped meetings? Would they really check on me, you know? I rotated out as delegate. It's like, well, I don't want to make coffee anymore. I've been the delegate, you know? That was then. I make the best coffee now, so no worries. But, you know, my head started taking over, you know? And I don't know about you, but alcoholics of my type, that's a very dangerous spot to be in. I've known a lot of long-timers. It takes a lot to be an old-timer these days. They keep moving it up, you know? It's 50 years now, so I'm not going to say old-timers, but long-timers. They quit coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And for the first time in my life, I kind of understood that. And so I was scared, you know? But at the same time, it was like, I'll be all right. I got this, you know? And I've got the spiritual kid, too. Well, I can do this, you know? And what happened is God has always intervened in my life to save me from myself. I had the opportunity, and I've always wanted to do this. I had the opportunity to become a traveling nurse. I'd gone back, well, actually, while I was delegate, I had gone back to school to become a nurse, and so I never believe people that say they don't have time for service, because I went through a divorce, I went through nursing school, came back, took my tests and all that kind of stuff after the general service conference and that sort of thing. But anyway, I'd become a nurse, and I always wanted to travel, and by this time, that son that I was telling you about was about ready to graduate high school. I think that was part of the whole mental thing, too. And he's my only son, so it was an empty nest type thing. And he was going off to Louisville, Kentucky, in the South. I'd not really been in the South before that time, so I wasn't sure what they did in Louisville, Kentucky. But I know now it's all good. They're all safe. There's no Kentuckians in here, I can tell. Woo! All right. At any rate, so I threw in my application, and I'm off to Durham, North Carolina. Yeah, there's a couple in here from there. And you know what? I got in the car, hoarded out my car. I packed everything I needed to live in my little Honda, and I went to Durham, North Carolina. And my normal friend said, "How are you going to meet people?" She was really confused, and I'm like, "Oh, I got this," you know. So I'm in the car. There's no radio. There's no cell phone. There's no nothing. It's just me and God. And I had that experience. And it was prayer under pressure. And I said, "God, please let me fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous again." Sorry. I don't cry. Anyway. That's another issue, another time. And it happened. I went to Durham, North Carolina. And because I had been involved in service, Guy gave me a number for a Beth. Beth, somebody that had spoken at one time, and called Beth up, and she connected me with another gal, and I was set. Within 10 minutes, I had which meetings to go to, what time to be there, who would pick me up, blah, 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 done. And started that journey again. It was all fresh. It was all new. And, you know, I share that story because sometimes in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't know if you're sitting next to the guy that may have tried to put a gun to his head right before the meeting, you know. So it... Yeah, I was there. Not I wasn't suicidal or anything, but it was just I wanted to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous again. And that just started my journey. Got to meet some fantastic gals with long-term sobriety while I was there, and then my next journey was to Yuma, Arizona, which was a fascinating place, right across the border of Mexico, you know. And then I went to Montana, and then I was over in Wisconsin. And everywhere I went, you guys were there in groves. Tonight or today, and during this conference, I've ran into so many people I've met and had relationships with. I mean, like, not just, "Hey, how's it going?" But like, we went to meetings together, and we studied the service manual. I don't know if that's a swear word here, but yeah. You know, have done those things together and have formed, you know, the hair on the back of my neck used to stand up in the 12 and 12 when it talks about our total inability to form a true and lasting relationship with another human being. It doesn't anymore. You know, God has helped me through that and to form those relationships that are priceless, absolutely priceless. And so I am eternally grateful for that. I will tell you that it is a privilege to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether it's my home group or, but this is really a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to be asked. I want to thank the General Service Office for asking me to do this. And as each time I get up to the podium, I hope that something I said, because that's really the purpose of why we get to the podium, will help somebody else. I mean, that's really how this works. And I thank you for your time.
Thanks, Estelle, for sharing your story with us. And among many, many other things, I think we had proof that we are not a glum lot. So thanks. And to wrap us up, we have Bill P. from New Hampshire.
I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I'm drinking my water now because I'm 69 and my talk would be cut short if I drank it while I was sitting over there. You're a good audience. This is fun. How many are here for their first convention? Oh. I know you've got a suspicion there's a lot of people here. But wait till tonight. It's awesome. The values here are just top shelf. People are here because they want to be sober, and the love and the stuff that you'll feel here is just unbelievable. I've always wanted, since my first meeting, I've wanted to stand at a podium like this and with a group your size. My first meeting in Hanover, New Hampshire in January of 1984, and I thought, where's my podium? You know? And there wasn't one. And I got I got to Montreal in 85, and you know, Lois was on the stage for her last international convention, and Jack Norris was down there, and I wanted to speak, and they told me to sit down and shut up. And, you know, and I kind of got used to that after a while. You know, maybe Seattle, I still would have liked to have gotten up and spoke at a podium and gotten clap and the whole thing that goes with it, but nobody asked me. And by San Diego, it was gone. It was okay that I was just another bozo on the bus, and I could just be there and hear the stuff. And Minneapolis was the same way. And, you know, so all of a sudden this year, I got asked to speak. And the reason is I sponsor a delegate. Now, up until now, I thought that people got up here because of what they knew, not who they knew. You know. So, if you want to do this, and trust me, it's really not that fun. But if you think you want to be up here, go find a newcomer and tell them how important service is, and then just wait. You know. How does this intertwine with prayer? I guess I would have to say that, you know, all those prayers that of getting up here finally were answered. And God answers all my prayers, yes, no, or wait. And this was a wait one. Almost everything I've gotten since I've been in this program, I got about 2 days after I didn't need to have it anymore. I would forget. I used to pray like mad for this or for that. And then I'd forget. One day, just like, you know, the day that you, remember the first day that you got up and you didn't think about drinking? Same thing. It's all of a sudden you just notice, I don't have to stand in front of a group at a international convention. And then it happens, you know. And I didn't even want to sponsor this guy. I'm not going to mention names. Only some of you know that I'm from New Hampshire. just to understand the value system, there's 12 people that go to meetings with me regularly, at least in this room, that showed up for this meeting. And some more waved to me that they couldn't get in. If I was home, if I was speaking at a regular meeting at home, they all would have found something else to do tonight. Yeah. So I think they're here to see if I fall on my face. which could happen. And anyway, it's wonderful. The love is wonderful. God tells me what to say, and he just stopped. It may or may not come back. I have to live with it all the time. You only have to live with it for about 15 more minutes. But, I used to pray. I heard it said already today, you know, I hope I can help. And I used to do that. I'd get on my knees before I'd speak and say, I hope I can help one idiot. And a couple of years later, I figured out who the idiot was. There's been one at every one of my meetings that's been in common. Anyway, this delegate that got me up here, I have to share this. I'll mention that I drank later. What was I going to say nice about him? I had something nice to say. Well, yeah, I didn't want him to be a sponsee. But so the first thing that I said to him when he asked me, I said, Sunday nights we're going to start to read, study the big book at my house on Sunday night, and we're going to apply these steps to our lives. And I said, we, not him, but we're going to do it together. I thought that might get him down. I thought maybe that would be the straw that would, he'd say, nah, I want to find an easier, softer way. But he didn't. He said, okay. He'd show up at my house on Sunday night. And I said, you're going to have to drop one of the steps you've been doing. And that was 13. And I thought if the 12 steps didn't scare him away, that having to give up the 13th would. And that didn't stop him. He says, okay, he'd do that too. And, now people in the New Hampshire area can go safely to meetings without... without worrying about that, because he said yes to both of them. And so I'm just getting even for him getting me up here in the first place. I'm not saying anything that I haven't heard him say at meetings, so that's sad. Also, it makes it a little easier for me to be up here, because I have a feeling in my gut about like I felt the first time I had to speak at a meeting, and my sponsor took me to Henniker, New Hampshire. It's the only Henniker on earth, and we had a guy with us named Billy L. Billy L. was just a beautiful speaker. He spoke in Montreal. He had a meeting, a bigger meeting than this. He'd spent 7 years doing hard time, and he'd spent another 7 years sober, and everything was lovely and beautiful, and he was just a colorful... Erna remembers Billy, do you? Yeah, okay. So I went with Billy and Jack down to this meeting in Henniker, and I didn't know I was in on anything. I thought I was along for the ride. And on the way in the door, my sponsor said, do you want a speaker, do you want a chair? And I thought... if you chair, you have to think. There's responsibilities with chairing. And I'd rather speak, you know, because then I just have to do what I'm doing now, just whatever comes out. So Billy L. Chaired the meeting, and while he's opening up the meeting, I just did. I had the same feeling that I have up here today, and I said to Jack, I said, what am I going to say to these people that's going to help them? They look like they've all been sober 100 years. And I've been sober about 95 days or something. And I said, what am I going to say that's going to help them? And Jack didn't even crack a smile or hesitate. He said, for Christ's sakes, nothing. He said, you're here to remind them how sick they were when they got here. So when I got up here today, other than hoping I might fall off the edge of the stage, I said, maybe I'm here to remind you. I was a barroom drinker, a blackout drinker. I lived in a little town. My drinking was difficult in a small town. If I was shut off in one bar, they called ahead. And I was shut off in other bars. I was an enthusiastic drinker. I loved, you know, I loved the lights. I loved the people that served the drinks. I loved the glasses they came in. You know, I heard somebody earlier today talking about a 30-pack, and they didn't have 30-packs when I was drinking. We had cases, and they had 24. I think if they had 30-packs, I might still be able to drink. Because at the end of a case, you know, I wasn't quite there. I was normal. I was about three drinks short of being normal. I always believed that. And I'm, you know, and I believe I'm a higher power short of being normal also. And either one of those things helps me towards that. But when I pray, if I get a little bit of what I want, I'm likely to stop. If I just get a taste of you know, happy, joyous, and free, I'm likely to stop short. I'm a person who believes in prayer. When I came in here, I was we're going to drop that other tangent I was on. I forgot my notes is what happened. But when I prayed before program, it was just to get me out of a jam. I had two kinds of prayers, foxhole prayers and Santa Claus prayers. And some of you know what Santa Claus prayers are. That's when I presume that, you know, what I want is what God wants, and we you know, I can pray for anything. We do it in church. I'm active in my church. We pray for stuff in church that I think is presumptuous. But anyway, those were the two kind of prayers that I had when before program. And today, it's pretty much the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. It's pretty much, you know, I offer myself to you to build with me, to do with me whatever you want, whenever you want. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I remember when I thought that, you know, victory over that would bear witness to those. I would help of thy power, thy way of life. I screwed that up. But it was about, you know, get me a nice convertible and I'll give newcomers a ride to meetings. You know. I believe things like that. Today I don't. I've come to believe that God's will for me is to stand up here for 15 minutes and do the best I can at carrying the message. I heard about rehabs this morning at one of my meetings, and I got sober right when rehabs were being sponsored by the government or by insurance companies. So there were lots of people coming in from rehabs. It was a beautiful painting. You know, we saw the families coming together and getting their loved ones into rehabs and doing it through interventions. And I didn't have anybody left that cared if I drank or not. There were no loved ones to crowd into the living room and talk me into a rehab. When I finally got to that point of desperation, I knew one bartender who was sort of sober to take me to a meeting. That warm, fuzzy rehab intervention feeling wasn't there. Nobody cared. My parents had given up on me. My wife had divorced me. I'd lost the chance for an education. I had one daughter who was, I think, just out of courtesy nice to me. But it was tough. So when I got here, it was because I had no place else to turn. I went to the one person that would take me. I went to him on a Saturday morning, Sunday morning, and he said, "I'll take you Thursday up to Hanover." And, you know, today when somebody says, "Will you take me to a meeting?" I'll say, you know, "We're going to leave right now because they might change their mind by Thursday." I didn't understand. My friends, you know, at the time it seemed perfectly normal to to wait 4 days to go to a meeting. But today I understood he had to sober up to take me. And I know, you know, that's the love that one alcoholic has for another. He could dry himself up to take me to a meeting, and where he couldn't do it for himself. And that's love. That's the kind of love we have here, that as we're all crowded in this place and we're trying to get different places and we're all going in different directions, and we all stop and say, excuse me, and we let people go through. One of the most touching moments I can remember from Montreal, where we all depended on the subways, and there was a meeting about six times this size, and they had a little mini countdown at the end, and everybody had been talking about gratitude and, you know, how they just flowery conversation about how grateful they felt. And they finally had a little mini countdown at the end of the meeting, and then they asked this guy with 42 years to come up to the podium. He was sitting way in the back. It took about an hour for him to get down to the podium, and I was impatient, as I usually was. I had brown hair and white teeth then. It was different. Instead of the other way around, I'm wondering what the tape people will do with that. But anyway, he finally got down to the podium, and he said, I wish that we could replace our gratitude with tolerance. And I had just remembered how we all pushed our way through that subway, and we weren't real tolerant, you know. And every convention I've been to, I can remember where it's been challenging to be tolerant and to be loving and kind to each other. And I think it was in San Diego where there would be little gaps where the buses stopped to pick us up, and they were about as wide as this podium. And you stand there like a good doobie, and I'm one of those good doobies. You stand where you're supposed to. But the next bus would stop down here, and they'd get a whole new bunch of people. And sometimes really elderly people, people with you know, with handicaps, people with just an age problem, were standing out there in the heat for way too long, because each time the bus came, it didn't stop in the right place. But I noticed things like that, you know, because I'm judgmental, too. Let me think. I got sober after a spell. I was sick and tired of just being a blackout drinker. You know, to be ill every morning and your sickness is based on a rumor that you had a good time last night it gets old fast. But you know, when I got here and I got active in service work, and I got active in other programs. I've AA is not my only program today, but it's the only one I'm going to talk about here, and it's just because of what I've learned. I learn a lot from my sponsees. I had a call this morning. I called him back. One of my sponsees, I have a sponsee in Bangor, Maine, who said, just remember, Bill, we were kind of joking about me having to stand up here. He knew I was uncomfortable with it. He says, just remember, Bill, there's going to be a couple of guys in the back row that are going to be judgmental of what you have to say. He said, if I were there, he said, I'd be one of them. So if there's somebody in the back row, I'll see you after the meeting. But, you know, I thought, what a cruel thing to say, but it's the truth. We only love half the people in here, and if we think we love them all, we haven't been to enough meetings. But it's an honor to stand up here. I had three talks, the one I was going to give, the one I gave, and the one I wished I'd given. You got the middle one. And I just want you to remember tonight, when you get in that dome and they ask for a moment of silence, listen. It's beautiful. I can't think of anything that maybe your heart will remember any more than that. I didn't talk about prayer under pressure, did I? I have 50 seconds. I do want you to know, though, that I did do that before the meeting. And that's the only reason I could stand up here. And I think one of the reasons my sponsee got me up here in the first place is because he's heard me more than once say it's okay to beg. It's okay to get on your knees and beg. And I will say that this morning when I got on my knees at the side of my bed, I pray with one hand up and one hand down, and one is to remind me that I need to receive from my higher power. The hand down is that I have to let go of some of those things that have been preventing me from getting that power from my higher power. And I do remember that. I looked over on the other side of the bed this morning. Oh, the bed was dry. That may be funny to you, but it isn't to me. We covered it with a smile, but I was Bill PP up until I got that sticker. And when they gave me that, I said, somebody's heard my story. But there was a woman in the other side of my bed this morning, and I knew who it was. And I didn't always. And I knew she was there because she wanted to be and not because she didn't have any other place to go. And on the bedstand next to my bed was a couple of dollars left over from yesterday. I didn't always have a couple of dollars on a Friday morning left over from yesterday. So I was already grateful. By the time I realized my head didn't hurt this morning, it wasn't pounding. My digestive system was in order this morning, and I was already grateful. By the time I asked God for help this morning, I was grateful. And that's the kind of prayer that has helped me to stay sober, at least through half of today anyway. I love you all. Thank you. Yeah.